Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Job loss is one of the most difficult life experiences that anyone will ever go through. Not only does it mean a loss of income, for a lot of people, it can mean a loss of identity. Well, this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the emotional impact of unemployment. And our guest is psychologist Robert Leahy. He says, while it may seem difficult to do this, it is possible to see losing a job as an opportunity to make changes in your life that will enrich your life, maybe to see yourself as a person that is more than just what you happen to do to earn a paycheck. So we'll be talking with him in this first hour of the show, and certainly encourage people who have questions or maybe have stories of their own experiences of job loss to offer. Before saying a little bit more about Dr. Leahy, let me just say something about this program. This program is part of a series that we're doing. It's called Will Connect, and it's a series that tries to look at the local economy to inform and connect you and the communities in East Central Illinois with one another and also with regional resources. And this whole series grew out of some conversations, some community conversations that WILL held this summer in Champaign, Vermilion, and Macon counties. We sat down, we talked with people, and we encouraged them to talk about their concerns. And then from those conversations, we tried to draw some issues that we could build programs around. And we'll be doing a number of them here on Focus 580. We'll be doing some on the Afternoon Magazine. Our news department will be doing some stories. And it's all part of this big effort that we've been doing for this summer. We also do have a website. And basically the idea of the website is to try to get together some information on contact organizations. So if people need various kinds of help and services, you can go to our website and then find out where to go from there. So you might want to look at that. That's Will Connect, and that's all as one word, willconnect.org/economy. Our guest for this first hour of the show today is Robert Leahy. He is director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy. He's also president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. He is clinical professor of psychology in psychiatry at Weill Cornell University Med School. He's also associate editor of the International Journal of Cognitive Therapy, and that's just part of his resume. I just want to pick a few things to talk about. He's also author and editor of 17 books, and a couple that I want to mention because they bear on the topic that we're talking about here are The Worry Cure, that is subtitled 7 Steps to Stop Worry from Stopping You, and that is a book that's published by Harmony Books. I'm sure you could find that in the bookstore at the library. Also, a more recent book, it's titled Anxiety Free: Unravel Your Fears Before They Unravel You. So questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, that one is free. That one's on us. So again, here, if you're local, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Questions, comments this morning certainly are welcome. Dr. Leahy, hello.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. You know, I read about how job loss is on this list of major life challenges, and at the same time, when you think about other kinds of loss, you think about divorce, for example, or you think about maybe loss of a parent or a spouse, something like that. Those, to me, loom pretty large, particularly the loss of a loved one. Can you really say, though, that job loss deserves a place on that list?
Well, job loss is kind of what you make of it, but the reality for many people is that job loss is usually financial loss unless people have a good bailout policy. It's loss of social interaction. It's loss of how you use your time during the day. And for some people, it's kind of a loss of their role or their sense of identity. Having said that, I think that there are ways in which people can cope with job loss in ways that could be productive, even though it's a very, very difficult thing to go through, and one always has to validate for anybody who goes through job loss, this is a major, major event in your life.
Yeah, I think that one thing that that makes this distinct is that there are really two levels on which it works, and you've really touched on both of them. And one is that for a person who's left a job, lost a job, there's going to be immediate kind of concerns about how do I pay the rent? How do I pay the mortgage? How do I buy food? How do I take care of my family? So that's going to be right away, right up front. But there is also this other set of issues, maybe a little bit deeper issues, that have to do with the fact that so many of us define ourselves by our work. We are what we do. So if we're not that anymore, then what are we?
Exactly. I mean, I think that that's a real problem in our culture, is that people over-identify with their job title. One of the concepts that I use with my patients is the idea of a life portfolio rather than a financial portfolio or a job portfolio. So your job could be part of this, you know, portfolio of who you are and what your life is. But there are other parts of your life other than your job. For example, your relationship with your spouse, your friends, your children, your participation in community, your spiritual life, your cultural life, your ability to learn, your leisure, your fun, your sense of values. If you take a circle and you think of it as a pie, and you make one small part of the pie your job and the other parts of the pie all these other things, then you basically are putting the job in the context of a larger life worth living. And I think that that's part of what I see with some people who, when they go through the job loss, they begin to examine, what is my life really all about? And I think if you begin to expand the meaning of your life to include all of these things, community, helping other people, spiritual values, family, like one of my patients who was going through a job loss after being employed for about 35 years in a bank, realized that now he had time to spend with his son, who he wasn't really seeing as much as he wanted to. He had time to spend with his wife. He had time to read. He had time to see his friends. He had time to exercise. And he actually had mixed feelings about going back to work, because he began realizing, I was so absorbed in my job that I was missing out on these other parts of my life.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I suppose we certainly have to acknowledge that not everyone, at least immediately, would be in the position to take stock and think of it that way,
right?
Because there are some people for whom the job loss is an emergency, that is, and that would be for people who are living from paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And I'm not sure exactly what one says to people like that. It's kind of hard to say to them, well, don't worry, because they obviously have something really important to worry about. Maybe the issue is, how is it that you, in a sort of constructive, action-oriented way, go at the problem right from the start?
Well, I think there's several steps in dealing with it. I think the first step is basically to validate that it's very difficult to lose your job. On the other hand, you can also look at how you can use your day. In other words, if you lose your job, it's a very difficult experience. You have every right to feel upset, every right to worry, as you point. I never say to people, don't worry, because that's never going to work. But what I do tell people is that even though it's really unpleasant and maybe unfair that you've lost your job, that it is a reality that you're going to have to cope with. In other words, it's kind of like, it's the given that I have to deal with. And then you have to sort of think, I can either ruminate about it, or I can be angry about it, or I can figure out ways of coping. I think that one way of coping is to normalize the problem, is to say to yourself, you know, there, what is it, 9.5% or 9.6% of the workforce is out of work, and unemployment is always part of the national economy. It's just much worse now than it's been in the last 30 years or so. I think the other part of coping and sort of taking action is making a plan for every day. So, for example, what I tell my patients is make a plan for every day, even for every hour of the day, and include in that plan that you have a job, which is looking for a job. You also have a job which is taking care of yourself, which could be, you know, getting more exercise, getting involved in other activities, maybe acquiring new skills, learning new things, connecting up with your network, finding, you know, following up on leads, getting involved in communities where you might make other contacts, or you might find that there are things that are worth doing. You may not get paid for it, but if you get involved in volunteer activities and volunteer organizations, you may make contacts with people who could possibly help you, and you could show that you're actually doing something very active and meaningful. I kind of look at this time for people who are unemployed as a time in between, because almost everybody who's unemployed eventually will get back into the workforce. So the question is, what do you do with this time in between? And there are problematic ways of coping. Problematic ways of coping are drinking a lot, isolating yourself, blaming everybody else, ruminating, kind of, going over and over in your head, why me? That's sort of part of the process for many people. And the initial part of the process is getting stuck there. The next part of the process is developing a plan, carrying it out, and using it perhaps as a way of clarifying what's really important. Like you mentioned, for example, loss of money, which is a major problem for people who are unemployed. One of the things that I think many of us in our society haven't really appreciated is all the things that we don't need. There was a famous Greek philosopher a couple thousand years ago named, Diogenes, who would run through the marketplace in Athens and scream out the names of all the things that he didn't need. And if you think about what do you really, really need, what do you really need to budget for, you might be able to find that, the things that you thought you needed, that you thought you needed the money for, are things that you don't really need. These are kind of excess things that we sort of have been, programmed to think that we have to have. So finding a budget and living within a budget is not only a good thing to do when you're unemployed, but it's a good thing to do when you are employed. I think a lot of times people find, if I develop the right coping skills during this time in between, I'm going to be better off coping when I get a job, and I can learn from this experience to make my life a better life in the future.
Our guest this morning in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Robert Leahy. He's director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy. He's on the faculty of the Weill Cornell University Med School. He's authored a number of books, and including The Worry Cure, Seven Steps to Stop Worry from Stopping You. That's the subtitle. And we're talking this morning about the emotional impact of job loss and how people can deal with that. And questions certainly are welcome. Maybe people have a story to offer about their experiences as well. Any of that, any and all of that is certainly welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's a good anyway that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I think you make a very basic, important point, and that is when you come to a challenge like this, it's very easy and understandable that to get depressed, mm-hmm. To get to the point where you just feel the blow of it, the weight of it seems to drain you of your ability to do anything except think about how bad it is. And it seems to me, again, this is maybe when you're in it, doesn't sound easy, but that in a case like this, action, sometimes it's almost any action is doing something is better than doing nothing.
Exactly, David. I mean, I think one part of depression is ruminating, where you repeat over and over all these negative thoughts and you focus on how bad you feel. Now, you could say, well, I have every right to feel bad, but that's true. But you also have every choice to engage in action that's productive. You may have a right to feel bad, but you also have a choice to do something that's productive. So one of the things that I ask people to think about when they begin ruminating and worrying and all this is, what is the advantage that you think you're going to get by focusing on how bad this is or how unfair it is? You may have a right to the feeling or the thought, but it's not going to be helpful to you to get stuck in it. It's kind of like spinning your wheels over and over and over again. The second thing to think about in relation to that is, rather than ruminate or worry, is there any productive, rewarding action that you can take today? So, for example, even if you have a job, and most of the people listening have jobs, you can ask yourself any day, any morning, when you're worried or you're ruminating, whatever, you can say, are there some productive things that I can do that are free? So, for example, you can, if you're married or you have children, you can be kind and loving toward your spouse or your children. If you have pets, you can be kind to them. You can enjoy listening to radio. You can listen to music. You can read. You can pray. You can help other people. There are many, many things that we can do that are free if we choose to do them. So it's a choice between ruminating and isolating yourself or doing things that are productive. In a way, sort of an antidote to being depressed and worried is to have a reward menu every day, things that I want to do that are rewarding to me. And you could add anything to that. It could be even cooking your favorite meal or listening to music or, you know, appreciating what's around you. I find that when people stand back and they think, okay, I may not have as much money as I had before, or maybe I have to watch my budget, but this now opens up my mind to what are the things that I really need to do that are free. Here's an exercise, David, that I ask you and everybody listening to think about. Just imagine you close your eyes and everything has been taken away. All your senses, your family, everything has been taken away. Your job has been taken away. Everything's been taken away. Now, I will give you one thing back at a time, but you have to make a case that you really appreciate it. When I've used this exercise, which is an appreciation exercise, I've never had any patient put their job or money on the list. What they do is they put on the list, I'd like my eyesight, I'd like my children, I'd like my wife or my husband, I'd like to be able to walk, I'd like to be able to hear music, I'd like to be able to feel. All of these things that are on the appreciation exercise list are things that are already available for almost everybody every day. But if you get focused on the job or the money, it takes away your perspective about what's really important. I've never had anybody put money on that list of things they wanted back.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them, and I believe that we'll start with someone here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Your guest, in his introductory remarks, he was talking about cutting back on expenses, you know, cutting back in consumption as a kind of a practical discipline of the recession. But I think that kind of cutting back actually became a necessity of reduced incomes when as people's income was reduced, it became a necessity. And a specific statistic that keeps sticking in my mind was the fact that economic analysts would continue to marvel at how Americans before the recession were spending more than their incomes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A great point that you're making, which is that one of the things that I hope is part of the learning curve, which I think you're really making an excellent point on, is that we've been spending more than we've been earning. We've been living on the hope that our real estate and our stock portfolios would rescue us in the future. And the reality of it is that this overspending and overconsuming has been 95% based on false needs. You know, you don't need the latest iPod or the latest BlackBerry or the latest car or the latest fashion. You don't need those things. You simply have been programmed to think that that'll make you happier. And if it made you happier, then why weren't you happy when you had those things? And how were you happy when you didn't have those things? So your caller makes an excellent point about overconsumption sort of leading people into the position of where they were constantly working to chase after things that they actually didn't need. This is a great opportunity for you. Just use the appreciation exercise, and you'll find that money in your job is not going to be on the list of things that you want back first.
So the recession was actually beneficial in that it taught us that we don't need all that superfluous stuff.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think that I try to start every day with trying to appreciate something that's free. I mean, I grew up poor. I'm not poor now. But I want to remind myself of being liberated from needs for material things every day.
Good program, David.
Oh, thank you. Well, I guess I'm still also moved to make the point that there probably were people before the downturn that were still pretty close to the edge, and there weren't people with BlackBerries and iPods, and that they were people who were pushed right when this happened, were
Absolutely.
Pushed right over the edge.
Right.
And the people who are they're not trying to figure out how can we continue to have luxuries in our lives. They're people who are saying, how can I survive? So we are talking about people at all sorts of levels here.
But, you know, sorry to interrupt you, David, but I think that the way that we describe it, the words that we're using, like pushed over the edge or surviving, is part of the kind of extreme way in which we view money and material possession. You can be pushed over the, quote, edge, but you know something, you're still standing. You can lose your job, but you're still going to survive. I mean, nobody's dying because they've lost a job. I would defy anybody to tell me anybody in the United States who's actually starved to death, you know, because they've lost a job. So, you know, I go back to my own experience. I grew up poor in a housing project. We were on welfare. You know, we had almost no money. But I didn't feel like I wasn't going to survive. I didn't feel like I fell over the edge. I think that one of the things that your caller, you know, really makes a great point about is that this emphasis on what we think we need, it may be overblown. And maybe this is an opportunity for us to examine what are the values that we have? What do we really need? You know, the appreciation exercise really kind of tells you what you need. I mean, if you had a choice between losing your job and losing your health, you know, which would you choose? Or losing your child and losing your money, which would you choose? You know, these kinds of value clarification things are very, very important for us to examine. I mean, we're the richest country in the world. You know, our population has been, you know, incredibly privileged. I mean, whatever the politicians say about the economy or whatever it might be, we're richer in the last 5 years than we were 30 or 40 years ago. But here's the catch. The rates of depression and anxiety have actually gone up. The average high school kid today, or in the year 2000, was as anxious as the average psychiatric patient in the 1950s. Even though you had an increase of affluence, privilege, houses are bigger, people having expanded credit, they have all these material things, even more vacation time and all this kind of thing. Why is it that this material advantage that we had didn't translate into being less depressed and less anxious? Why weren't we the happiest people in the world? We had more. But the problem is not necessarily having more. It's what you think you need.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Leahy. He's director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy. He is president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, clinical professor of psychology at the Weill Cornell University Med School. He's the author of a number of books, including The Worry Cure and Anxiety Free, Unravel Your Fears Before They Unravel You. And we are talking this morning about the emotional impact of job loss and how people cope with that. And again, I just want to mention that this program here this morning is part of a Will Connect. It's a series taking a look at the impact of the downturn in the economy on communities here in East Central Illinois. And the idea is to try to get people talking with one another about what's going on in their communities. And we had a series of community conversations this summer in Champaign, Vermilion, and Macon counties. And what we tried to do was listen to what people said and then select from that some topics that we could talk about here on the program. And this is one of them. Our website for this project is Will Connect. That's W-I-L-L, Connect, all as one word, willconnect.org/economy. We have another caller here, and we'll talk with them. And this is someone on our toll-free line right here, line 4. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Comment first, and then example. Sounds like Joel Osteen to me, and positive thinking, and somehow you will survive. How you will survive is never the focus of how you do it. My example would be with the Clunker program in the news, and I got this right from the news media, that the destruction of the old clunker and the ruination of it, except for salvageable parts, has now reduced the repair shops to 50% of what they had been doing before. Well, be that as it may, that's the figure I heard on the radio. So taking that into account, then we go right back to the sludge pit of the guy that is laid off or closes his shop, goes to junior college, he gets some expertise, and then he graduates on to the next stage of his dilemma. which at the bottom of all that is the capitalist imperialist paradigm that lives on consumerism and has a lock around the throat of the general public, especially in the U.S., which is privileged, you know, with 200 million with no health care, another 100 million living in poverty, and how that is designed and or cured by psychological positive thinking is not a mystery, but it is predictable.
Well, I don't know how you might comment on that, Dr. Leahy.
Well, I'm not sure what the question is, but I certainly understand that there are people whose jobs are disappearing, and those particular jobs are going to disappear forever. I had a patient a number of years ago who was focused on trying to pursue a particular career, and he was getting absolutely nowhere, and he was unemployed most of the time. And I asked him, you know, if this particular career never existed, what else would you do? What else could you do? This is a very smart, creative, very, very nice, good person. And he began to examine the options, and it was like an eye-opening thing. He had been so fixated on this is the only thing that I can do. What we did is we opened up the idea of being flexible and being adaptive and thinking about problem solving, which, by the way, is not the power of positive thinking. I view it as the power of realistic thinking, you know, that being flexible, being a problem solver, you know, taking time, acquiring new skills, all of these kinds of things. Well, you know, every year I get a Christmas card from him. He's living in California. He's a psychiatric nurse. So he pursued something that he had never thought of doing before. Your caller makes a good point, though, I think, in regard to the fact that there are people who lose jobs, who can't, you know, who can't find jobs in that particular career slot. One thing you can think about is if you stretch time, if you take longer to look, if you're flexible geographically, if you're more aggressive and cast a wider net, if you're willing to take a step backwards, those are problem-solving strategies, which all of them have costs and they have some benefits. No strategy is going to be completely positive. They're all going to have some downside, some difficulty, some frustration, and some delay. You know, I want to make a comment, though, about your caller characterizing what I'm saying as just simply kind of Pollyannish positive thinking. None of this is Pollyannish positive thinking. This is a recognition that you validate that it's difficult, that the loss of jobs, unemployment, that in one study, people between the ages of 16 and 44 who had lost their jobs 20 years later, this particular age group, had a mortality rate 50% higher than people who had not lost their jobs. So losing your job can actually kill you in the long term. This is serious business. Losing your job is related to not only higher mortality, higher depression, higher binge drinking, all of these other things. Here's another interesting fact, David, that I was surprised to find. When they did a study where they combined all the studies that they could find, what is the relationship between unemployment and marital satisfaction? Probably intuitively, your listeners and I would have thought, oh, if you lose your job, you're going to have an increase in marital conflict. Mm-hmm. When they combined across all studies done, there was no direct relationship between losing your job and marital dissatisfaction. And why would that be? Well, in some marriages, what you find out when you lose your job, I'm really happy that I have my wife or my husband. I'm really happy I have my kids. You know, I really know that they're on my side. You think about times that you've had difficulties in your own life. Don't you find out who your real friends are? So sometimes losing a job can lead to recognizing that you have more support. Sometimes you find that when you lose your job, you have more conflicts, more arguments, and you have more difficulties. Hmm. So there's no free lunch. All of these things have trade-offs. And I think your caller raises an important point, and that we don't want to become this sort of, like, you know, put on a happy face and everything will be great. That's not in any way a realistic way of approaching anything in life.
I want to thank the caller and go on to somebody else here. We have a caller on line one next. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for having programs like this. I think it's really important. Dr., you laid out a scenario that actually mirrored my life 27 years ago. Within less than 6 months, my husband died, my kids had graduated school and moved off, I had to sell my business, I lost my home, my lifestyle, the whole. And back then, since I was relatively young, the people in my life who were friends and colleagues and whatever, I don't think being with somebody who was either now not married, not a business owner, you know, whatever, I lost all of them, too.
Wow. Terrible time for you.
It was a zoo. But, so, you know, you wake up one morning and you're no longer the labels that you were, you know, a minute before.
Yeah.
You're not, you're no longer a spouse, you're no longer a business owner, you're not no longer a homeowner, you're no longer all of those nouns. You know, you're not an active parent day to day. You're no longer those things. But it was really important to look at the situation and see if there was anything actually that wasn't lost. And what I saw was that all of the skills that made me able to be a partner, a parent, a teacher, a learner, a comrade, all of those things lived inside of me. And so those things actually didn't die. Those things were there for, you know, for the tapping into when, and I don't know if you've used this word, when the abject grief finally lifted somewhat. It took a long time. Back in those days, there was no one to talk to, so for me it took quite a long time. But, so I wanted to tell you that, you know, there's a way of defining yourself in terms of being a victim to the circumstances and a victim to who you thought you were in terms of a label, but really, what are you made of? And isn't it still there? So that's one thing. The other thing about, unless I misunderstood, it seems I thought I heard you kind of comparing, comparing a job loss to losing a kid is like whatever. And I have found in grief, it's just like a personal grief, you know. You just can't, when somebody is hurting for grief reasons, it just feels bad.
Sure. Let me make a comment, and thank you so much for sharing your experiences. I think what you're telling people is going to inspire people because you've gone through living hell and you've come out with a lot of wisdom and a lot of humanity. And I think what you found is that you are larger than the labels, that you are a bigger person. You're not just defined and reduced to a label or a category. You are you, and there's nobody in the world that's exactly you. And all the things that you said, I think you have a great deal of wisdom that you're sharing here. You ought to be writing your own book here. That you're saying that that I said to myself, you know, I was the person who had a relationship. I was the person who had a job. I was the person who had these abilities. In other words, you defined yourself not in terms of a label, but in terms of capability and in terms of hope and in terms of being an agent of change in your own life. And that's why I think your story is, I'm sure there are going to be people listening now who are going to say, I really wish I could talk to her because she's inspired me with her story.
Well, thank you for that. And may I offer, as if I don't lose my train of thought. I think it's also, if you're filled with the sense of loss, you can also feel what you are missing desperately. In a lot of cases, that would be, you know, relationship-oriented. And I thought something that was helpful to me was, knowing that I love music and knowing that, you know, I love having a drink of scotch with a cigarette or whatever, to find where in the community I could create something bigger than just what my life was, and make my way there. Sometimes you could just sit in a place, a coffee shop, or some place that feels homey mm-hmm. to you, and you expand your environment.
Well, one of the things that your life experience illustrates is what the research actually shows. I mean, when I mentioned that the rate of anxiety has gone up in the last 50 years, one of the main reasons for that is the decrease in a sense of a stable community, a mm-hmm. sense of connectedness, mm-hmm. and a sense of clear values. So, for example, 50 years ago, if you grew up in a neighborhood, you lived there throughout your childhood, you knew your neighbors, you were out playing. You know, I grew up in a housing project filled with Irish working-class Catholic kids. We used to play basketball every single day. These were tough kids. Mm-hmm. But we always had a sense of community. We always had a sense of belongingness. We kind of knew who we were. We didn't have any money, but we had each other. And I think one of the things that your experience illustrates is that you can connect with other people. For example, one of the things that when you're in this time of in between the last job and the next job is to think about, are there communities that I could, you know, belong to? Churches, synagogues, Habitat for Humanity. Are there volunteer organizations? Maybe you could go to ChicagoVolunteers.org or some website, which will probably give you 1,000 different volunteer activities. I've had patients of mine who've been worried about, you know, they've lost their job and, you know, worried about the future and stuff. And they say, well, why don't I go and volunteer at an animal shelter? Or why don't I go and volunteer at a housing shelter, a homeless shelter, or go to a hospital and help out, or, you know, work with elderly people and go visit them?
Well, I guess that's what I'm thinking that is difficult for people when they're in a time of grief. They sort of can't remember what they might like to do, but they can maybe feel the feelings of the particulars about what has been lost. So that if you've, you know, loved the idea of welcoming the kids home after school, mm-hmm. then go right to the school or go right to baking, cooking, you know, feel the very thing in the competence in the thing that's part of who you are.
Well, I think I think a lot of times where we get frustrated is where we think we have to get rid of a feeling. So, for example, you bring up, I think, very wisely the idea that losing a job does involve some sense of grief and loss and sadness and mm-hmm. anger and all that. I believe that, you know, you have every right to those emotions.
Sure.
But what you can also do is that you could expand the meaning of your life so that your life is large enough so that you can say, you know, I know I still feel angry and sad about the loss of the job, but I also have a life that's meaningful enough that's able to contain that sadness.
I agree.
Trying to get rid of the sadness.
No.
I never say to somebody, stop feeling sad or stop feeling bad. You know, what I would suggest is hold on to that feeling of sadness, but put it into the context of the larger part of what your life is and what it could be.
If I could just make one more comment and I'll
sure.
get off. I think actually with the economy, it's a perfect, perfect opportunity to for some people to either revisit for the first time in 40-some years or for people who are too young to see what it feels like to collaborate with others, to share resources, to
right.
have potlucks, to do something that's bigger than just taking care of, you know, the material needs of a very small, either you and your spouse or a little family. It's a very huge opportunity that's opened up for people actually to create, feel, walk into a whole new experience that we actually enjoyed very much in the 60s and 70s, no matter what side of the spectrum you were on, you could even look at people and say, oh, he's probably somebody that thinks like me, and the same with the, you know, polar opposite. And it was a big thing that got lost to people in the 80s. And
right, yes.
So I'm hoping that something big like that can come.
There's a wonderful book by psychologist Gene Twenge, who I would suggest you might have on your program, David.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is called The Narcissism Epidemic, which just came out a few months ago. Absolutely magnificent book. And what your callers, several of your callers, I think, are bringing up is that, you know, we become very materialistic, very narcissistic, very much full of ourselves, and all of this kind of thing. And that makes us ultimately dissatisfied with life. You know, I'll give you an example in my own life, which may sound rather trivial in a way, given all these things that people are dealing with. You know, I remember one night I was walking home from work, and I was to meet my wife at a restaurant, and I was in a lousy mood, and I was probably annoyed about something rather trivial. And there was an elderly woman who was trying to cross one of these streets in New York City, which is pretty dangerous for almost anybody. And I said, can I help you? And I helped her cross the street. And I noticed myself feeling better. I felt like this feels good to help an old lady cross the street who was afraid that she might get hit by a car. And she thanked me. And I said, no, I want to thank you. You've helped me. And I think that that's something that we often miss, that we go through our own pain, but there's always somebody out there who could use our help. There's always somebody else, a friend or family member or stranger or whatever, who can use our help. And I think a lot of times what I find with people who are going through losses, whether it's a job or whatever it might be, if you can sort of get outside of yourself for part of the day or part of the week and see if there's some compassion or kindness or generosity that you can extend to somebody else. No one can take, they can take away your job, but they can't take away your compassion or your kindness.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller very much for her comments. You know, this makes me think of some of the things that came up in these community conversations that we had this summer that I've mentioned a couple of times. And there are some things that came through very strongly. One is that people wanted to take pride in their communities,
yes,
that they in fact do take pride in many things in their communities. They're not often not very happy with the news media because they think all we do is we look at the negative stuff. But it seems really the case that people are, they're looking for ways to build the notion of community. And they think, you know, they understand that there are a lot of challenges, and in some places diversity issues are a real challenge. You know, trying to get different kinds of people together. And I think that that maybe part of the problem is that either we've lost the institutions that build community and we need to figure out how to either revive them or build new ones, or that maybe some of those kinds of institutions are still there, but that people have lost touch with them. I don't know. It seems that people are really looking for ways to do this and maybe aren't quite sure how.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think not only do we need each other, but we need to need each other. That we need to realize that other people are very, very important in our lives. That doesn't mean, I mean, when you lose your job, you may lose contact with those people at work. But there are 310 million or so people in the United States that you could possibly connect with. A few of those people, you can connect with communities on some of these internet communities like LinkedIn and Facebook and other communities, but also churches and organizations where people get involved in helping other people or have similar interests. You know, so a lot of the sense of loss. You know, life is sort of like a yin and yang. It's kind of like, yeah, you've lost the job, but can it open your eyes up to other things in your life that you've been missing? Why not try to find something in this very difficult, very trying time you're going through? Try to find something that you can take home with you and that you can use every day for the rest of your life. I had an interview with somebody a while ago, and she said, you know, these are good ideas even if you haven't lost your job. It's true. Mm-hmm. These are ways of living your life. Going back to your previous callers and what you've just said, David, that the ancient Stoic philosophers in Greece and Rome basically said what your goal in life should be should be to pursue your virtue. And what is virtue? Virtue are the qualities that you would admire in somebody else, like courage, compassion, integrity, kindness, self-discipline. No one can take away your virtue. No one can keep you from having integrity or compassion. And if you begin thinking, you know, all right, I was focused on the job, I was focused on materialism, and I'll try to get another job, I'll try to make more money, but let me try to get my head clear. Maybe I should try to become the kind of person that I would admire if I met that person, a person with integrity and compassion, a person who is kind, a person who has self-discipline. And you can start doing that today. You can start practicing those habits today.
Certainly something that I've noticed, and particularly it seems to be the case over the last few months, is even among people who would say that they're doing okay, you know, maybe they're in organizations, though, where people have been laid off or lost their jobs. They still have their jobs, but other people have lost theirs. It seems to me that there is out there in the world a kind of a constant but low-level sort of hum of anxiety that's just sort of there. And it never goes away.
Right.
And it's not, you know, not bad enough so that you would feel I need to go to a therapist or that I need to have some medication. And yet it's there. And also it would not surprise me to know that there had been a big uptake in sort of minor but significant stress-related illness just
right.
Generally. You know, and that's one of the things that I'm wondering about is that how you deal with that sort of low-level background constant hum of anxiety that maybe doesn't rise above the nuisance level, but, you know, day after day that gets to be kind of wearing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the good pieces of news is that in a recent Gallup survey, feelings of well-being and psychological health have actually improved since March. They had gone down over the prior year related to the economic downturn. So things are beginning to turn up in a better direction. But having said that, one of the things that we ought to be thinking about is what are these daily stressors that you go through? You know, I guess maybe I'm getting older and I've learned that I have to accept that things are not always going to be exactly the way I want them to be. Rather than struggling and trying or protesting, it's not going to be exactly what I want it to be. Sort of say, well, it is what it is. How can I deal with it? How can I cope with it? How can I make it not a really big problem in my life? A lot of the problems that we think we have are the problems that we make in our head as big problems. Someone doesn't like us. We're delayed in traffic. You know, we're late on work. We make these into, in our minds, enormous, enormous problems. Maybe they're just simply a bump in the road as we travel on the journey of life.
I do think it makes me think again about the comments from earlier caller, and I don't intend to criticize anybody or make an example of them. I hope that I wouldn't do that. But if you have something, and maybe it's not something that you think is a small bump in the road, but something about the world and the way that it works that just makes you really unhappy because you think fundamentally it's just not right. And yet at the same time, it's something that's big enough so that one, to be honest, you'd have to say, well, I think the chances of that thing changing are pretty small.
Right. And I think, you know, I think the easiest thing sometimes to change are your expectations. I mean, it's like being stuck in traffic. And if you keep, you know, banging the dashboard every day when you're stuck in traffic, maybe you ought to change your expectations about the traffic flow. You know, a lot of frustration in life are the demands and expectations that we think we have to meet. So knowing what you can change and what you can't change is the first piece of wisdom about having a life with less stress.
So we're coming down to the point here where we have maybe about a minute or so left. Are there some final thoughts that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, you know, I think as we said in the program, that I think the first thing to do is to validate yourself or anybody who's going through this experience of unemployment. It's a very, very difficult experience. Having said that, there are ways of coping that may make it less stressful, or actually may even create some opportunities of clarifying your values. I think some people feel a sense of shame when they're unemployed. I mean, we have 9.6% of the population unemployed, or at any one time we usually have, you know, 8 or 9 million people unemployed. Today we have maybe 14 or 15 million. Western Europe went through long periods of high unemployment for 20 years back in the 80s. So you have unemployment as a fact of life. It doesn't mean that you're a loser if you've lost your job. It just simply means that you're somebody who's in an economy where things change. I think isolating yourself and ruminating is not an adaptive way of coping. Finding action every day that you can engage in, you know, using what we call cognitive behavioral techniques of changing the way you think and changing the way you behave, change the way you interact, reduce your rumination, reduce your self-critical thoughts, directing some compassion toward yourself, building appreciation, expanding your sense of a life portfolio, as your caller indicated that. She's not just the label. She's the capacity, the capability, the agency to make things happen.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest is Dr. Robert Leahy. He's a psychologist. He's director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy. He's also on the faculty at the Weill Cornell University Med School. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent, you might want to look at this, is titled Anxiety Free, Unravel Your Fears Before They Unravel You. And also you might look at his book, The Worry Cure, 7 Steps to Stop Worry from Stopping You. Dr. Leahy, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, David, for having me on.